We'll run that for the next hour. And
how long is it going to be, Paul? Roughly when is it coming?
They said around 12 o'clock.
So how long do you want me to do this for?
Maybe one
till he comes, or till 12?
Till about 12, quarter past 12. Is that okay?
Yeah.
All right, that's brilliant.
Right, well, I'm going to be the warm-up act for Jay Smith. And, I've been doing a series of talks on Galatians recently, and they add up to about 8 or 9 hours in total. I've gone through each of the chapters, plus I've also done some a long tour through the Bible, dealing with passages which either appear to contradict Galatians, because there are one or two like that, and also many, many others that support and endorse Galatians. But what I'm going to do today, rather than try to get all of that into one talk, if I just give you an introductory talk about what Galatians is about, because it's one of the most important letters, and I've found from experience that people find it difficult. They shouldn't find it difficult, but they do find it difficult. And one of the reasons it's found difficult is because it's not really taught on. The letter to the Galatians is very rarely spoken about. But it's a really important letter, and the profound issue that it deals with is this. Are we or are we not under the law of Moses? Now, how many times have you been involved in discussions on that subject? And people bring forth all sorts of powerful views, deeply held views on the subject, where there's usually a lot more heat than there is light about it. And so what I want to do today is address the subject as Paul did. Now, Paul went into great detail. I don't have time to. But let's just address the overall issues. Are we or are we not under the law of Moses? And before we can answer that, let's just define, what do we mean by the law anyway? Because when the Bible speaks about the law, for example, when Jesus speaks of it in Matthew 5, the Greek word used is nomen, N-O-M-E-N in English, nomen. Now, the word law is a confusing word because it has many different meanings, and it depends on context what is being meant, just as many English words depend on the context for you to decide which meaning of the word is being used at that particular time. So when we speak of the law in the Bible, it depends. We could be meaning the 613 commands of Moses. We could mean that. Or you could mean the 5 books of Moses. Now, those are much larger than the law of Moses, because the 613 commands are within the 5 books, Genesis to Deuteronomy. But you could mean the 5 books, which is much bigger. Or you could mean the whole Hebrew Scriptures. And depending on context is what's meant. So when the psalmist in Psalm 119 goes on and on and on about how marvellous the law is, he isn't only talking about the 613 commands. At various times he's talking about other things too. And when various people in Scripture speak of the law, they mean one or other of those different things. But what I'm going to zero in on is this. Because we all know that the Bible is still valid. We all know that the 5 books of Moses are still valid. Of course they're valid. The question that exercises us is this. Are the 613 commands of Moses still applicable to us? Are we under them? And in amongst those 613, by the way, are the 10 commandments. There are 10 plus 603 makes 613. Now that whole package is the law of Moses. And that's the definition I'm going to be using today when addressing this question, are we under it? Because it has huge significance for us. And the reason Paul wrote this letter is basically because he got into a running argument about whether we are or are not under it. Now, in particular, he had to correct Apostle Peter. He shouldn't have had to, because Peter had been given the vision in Acts chapter 10. Do you remember, of the sheep coming down with the creatures and the reptiles and all the rest? And God told Peter 3 times not to call anything unclean that he has called clean. And what was the purpose of that vision? Firstly, to tell Peter the Gentiles are in. You're now to go to them. I want you to go to them. Now, God had to tell Peter that three times because that was such an unthinkable thing that he could not possibly have been hearing God right if he'd just heard it the once. He'd have thought he was just hallucinating. So God told him three times because he knew how hard Peter would find that message to hear. So that's the primary point that God was making. But there's another point, which is borne out later. And that is that, moreover, the kosher rules are over. So all the kosher rules about what kind of animals you can and can't eat, those are gone. Now, if the kosher rules are gone, so is the law of Moses. Because the kosher rules are an important, profound part of it. Now, why do we say if one part is gone, it's all gone? Because James tells us, doesn't he, in the letter of James, that if you break one part of the law, you're a lawbreaker. Now, if you break any part of the law, you are a lawbreaker. Therefore, if we were to break the kosher rules, we would be a lawbreaker. If we were to break anything, we would be a lawbreaker. So it's really important to know that the entire law of Moses is at an end. Now, this is where people get into a lather. Because they'll say, well, yes, but surely you're not saying that we can murder, we can steal, we can do all these things. No, we cannot. But the reason that we can't murder or steal is not because of the law of Moses. We can't murder or steal because Jesus has told us we can't murder or steal. So if you take the 10 commandments, just narrow it down to the 10. 9 of those are restated specifically in the New Testament. One of them isn't, and that's the 4th commandment about the Sabbath. That is not restated. And so the law relating to the Sabbath is a part of the law of Moses, and that has not been restated, and we are not under a Sabbath law. It's not part of what we're now under. Because what we're now under is something quite different. The law of Christ. And I'll try and explain that a little more fully later on. But the law of Christ has a different purpose. It works in a different way. It has a different objective. And also, the law of Christ assumes that you have a great deal more maturity. The law of Christ gives you a great deal more latitude and freedom as to how you do things than the law of Moses did, which was very prescriptive and exact and precise. Okay. So, what I'm getting at is this, because this is the management summary of the entire thing that takes a long time to go through. Paul came up against this thing. The people called the Judaizers, the circumcision party. Now, this was a group of people. They were within the church. They were Christian. They were Messianic Jews, as we would now call them. At the time, that wasn't a phrase that was used. But they were Jewish people who had accepted Jesus as Messiah. Okay, that's what they were. So they weren't Jews who did not accept him as Messiah. Now, there's a problem that the letter to the Hebrews deals with, is leaving Christianity to go into Judaism without Jesus Messiah. That's not the problem we're talking about here in Galatians. What we're talking about here in Galatians is the same problem that we were talking about in Acts chapter 15 when they had the Jerusalem Council. And the question is this. It's whether a person who becomes a Christian, in particular a Gentile, does he have to also accept and observe the law of Moses? Now, this was a massive issue. And over that issue, Paul wrote this letter to tell you that you do not have to obey the law of Moses. You don't have to obey any part of it. The entirety of the law of Moses is over. Now, as I said, Paul ought not to have had to write this letter. Because there was another man who wrote a letter. Do you know who wrote a letter earlier on? James. And I'm not talking about the book of James. Because James, the book of James, is later on in the Bible. But back in Acts chapter 15, do you remember when they had the council and everybody came and spoke and put their contribution in? Including Peter, Paul, James. At the end of it all, James was the chairman and he summed up. And it's really important to listen to what James had to say back in Acts chapter 15. Because frequently, James is used his name is misused as if he was an advocate of being under the law. You know, from the letter of James, how he speaks about, you know, how you show me your faith and I'll show you my works, my faith by my works. Faith without works is dead. Now that's a very true and accurate and necessary thing to say. And what James was saying there is absolutely right. So we're saved by faith alone, but real faith is always accompanied by works. It's like saying a real fire is always accompanied by smoke, but smoke isn't fire. Do you see? We're not saved by the smoke, we're saved by the fire, but real fire always brings smoke with it. So real faith will be accompanied by works. But we're not saved by works. We're saved by faith alone. So James's point was a quite different point that he was making in the letter of James, saying that your faith must not be simply theoretical, abstract, in your mind only, unaccompanied by any change of life or action or deeds or direction or attitude. What James was saying was a specific point. Real faith brings about change in your life. If there isn't change in your life, then whatever it is you've got, it's not faith. Do you see? Now that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about in Acts 15 is a different thing. And the little letter that James sends is basically the product of this conference in Jerusalem, the Jerusalem Council. So I labour this because many people think that the Galatians letter is just Paul having a bad day. He had a bad day at the office. He got a little confused. He wrote Galatians, but it's just Paul, so don't worry about it, because it's only Paul that thinks this. Everybody else thinks we're under the law of Moses, including James. And so don't worry about Paul. He was just having a bad day, and you don't have to worry about Galatians. It's contradictory to the Bible. Well, that's absolutely silly. It's not in the slightest bit inconsistent with the rest of the scripture. In fact, once you start searching the Bible, as I did recently, I read the entire New Testament just looking for references to the law and whether we're under it. Have you ever done that? Read the Bible just for one thing. And I've searched it. And do you know what you find if you do that? It's continually talking about it and telling you that you're not under the law. And you find it when you start looking. You tend to just drive by and not notice if you're not looking for it. But back to the point. What did James write in Acts chapter 15? He wrote that little letter. And in it, he summed up, what is it that you actually have to be bound by? What should you do? And what James did, summing up the entirety of the council. So it wasn't just James's view. He was summing up what the council decided. Is that the Gentiles are not under it. Okay? And not only that, but he refers to it as a yoke. Where does he say it? He speaks of it. Why do you put them under a yoke? Oh yes, verse 10. Now therefore, why tempt ye God to put a yoke upon the neck of the disciples, which neither our fathers nor we were able to bear? I'm reading out of the King James here. I normally read from the RSV. But James is referring to the law of Moses as a yoke. Moreover, which is a negative expression, but moreover, he's saying that neither they nor anybody else ever was ever able to keep the law anyway. And that's an important point to keep hold of, because there are many people today, surprisingly many, and I keep getting tweets from them on Twitter, who say that we're under the law. They're adamant about it. They want to be under the law. They want to observe this and observe that. Now the point is this. Remember what James said. If you want to put yourself under the law, you've got to obey all the law. Paul says that too. If you're going to be under the law, you must obey all of the law. You can't have some of the law. You must obey all of the law. Because if you disobey any part of the law, you are a lawbreaker. All right? Now in this letter that James writes in Acts chapter 15, he summarizes what should we get these people to do. And all he does is give them a little short list, do you remember? About not eating blood or things that are sacrificed to idols, things that are strangled and so forth. And interestingly, in that little tiny summary of advice he gives to the Gentiles, have you ever noticed He never mentions the Sabbath. Now, wouldn't you think if the Sabbath was something we had to keep, and when James, on behalf of the entire council, was summarizing our ongoing obligation, he would have mentioned it? So if in doubt about whether we're under the Sabbath, I think you can gain strong deductive evidence from James's little letter that he sends out to the whole church, that his non-mention, his non-reference to the Sabbath is a very important omission from that thing, particularly bearing in mind the very purpose of that little letter was to tell you that you're not under the law, and here are some things we recommend the Gentiles to do. And he does not mention the Sabbath. Okay. Now, the letter to the Galatians comes about really because this problem, which ought to have gone away, didn't go away. And so years later, Paul is in this situation where the circumcision party, who never, incidentally, they never go away. They didn't go away. They always followed Paul about, telling people they should be under the law. And they still haven't gone away. So the Galatian circumcision party is still here today. They're not big on circumcision, but they are big on Sabbath and other things that you must do. So it's never really gone away. That's why we need to get clear on this. So Paul comes up against it and he decides he's got to do something. And one of the particular things that provokes him is that he sees even Apostle Peter weakening on this point. Now, why did Peter weaken and how did he weaken? He was afraid of the circumcision party. He was intimidated by them. And who hasn't been intimidated at various times? Have you ever been in a situation where you've been afraid to say what you think? You've been scared to stand up and contradict something? Well, that's what Peter was in. So although Peter was a great man, on that occasion, his fear got control of him and he was intimidated by the circumcision party and he let them basically set the agenda. Now, Paul saw this and we're told in Galatians chapter 2 that Paul confronts Peter. He says, "But when Peter was come to Antioch, I withstood him to his face because he was to be blamed." Okay? You know the passage. He says, For before that, certain came from James. He did eat with the Gentiles. But when they were come, he withdrew and separated himself, fearing them which were of the circumcision. The circumcision means the circumcision party. He was afraid of them, basically, what they'd say. He was afraid of just being denounced by them. Because they had quite a hold over people. Well, Paul wasn't afraid. And he stood up to Peter and he stood up to everybody over this issue. And the whole letter to the Galatians, if you can boil it down, is telling you that you are not under the law of Moses. Now, if you want to check this out also further, start looking at the other letters, in particular Paul's letters, with this in mind. Start looking at Romans, 1 Corinthians, looking even at Hebrews, which I think Paul wrote. But whoever wrote it, he agrees with Paul. And the point is, start looking at the whole of the Bible, the whole of the New Testament, with this question in mind. And what you'll see is consistent corroboration for this point that we're not under the law of Moses. Now, let me just say a little about why does it matter anyway? Let's imagine a person wants to be under the law of Moses. What are they really saying? The essence of it is really this. Because they're saying you need justification and. You need to be saved and. Okay? Now, what do we mean by salvation? The word salvation it has three essential aspects or tenses or stages, you could call it. So you begin with something which happens in an instant, and that's called justification. Now, justification, at the moment a person is converted, it can happen between the saddle and the ground. Between the saddle and the ground, he mercy sought and mercy found. What does it mean? It's an old rhyme. It means the arrow hits him in the back, in the middle of the battle. He repents, and while he's falling off the horse and before he hits the ground dead, He's repented, believed, and been saved. That's the point. Now, justification can happen like that. When a person believes and repents, at that moment of justification, what happens is the entire righteousness of Jesus Christ is imputed to a person. So at that moment, they suddenly go from being a sinner in God's eyes, worthy of wrath, to being all of a sudden equally righteous as Jesus Christ. And that's not just a theoretical thing, that's literally the status that you then have as of that moment. Now from then on, you enter into another stage, and this one takes about 60 years or so, during which you are sanctified. So this is now sanctification. It's the second stage, or second tense, of salvation. Now, for those 60 years, you get saved at the age of 19, you go for until you're 79 or 89, getting sanctified. What's that? Changing in your day-to-day life, behavior, attitudes, crucifying the flesh, overcoming your old man, allowing your new man to come to the fore, changing in the way you speak, think, act, your priorities, becoming more godly, developing the fruit of the Holy Spirit in your character. That's sanctification. It's an aspect, it's a stage of salvation, but it's not justification. And the whole process of sanctification contributes nothing to the process of justification. The process of justification begins and ends in a second. It's over and done with in 1 second, completed. Sanctification takes a lifetime. And then there's another stage, comes right at the end, called glorification. That too is part of salvation. Glorification is the future tense of salvation. Now what's glorification? Well, to get glorified, you've either got to die or be raptured. One of those two things. Again, it's instantaneous. A bit like justification, instantaneous. But that's when it happens at the end. That too is part of salvation. So that's why we can say, I am saved, I have been justified, I am being saved, I'm in a process of sanctification, I will be saved, I'm going to be glorified when I die or am raptured. So those are the tenses of salvation, and we need to know those tenses in order to look at this letter properly. Because this letter is talking about the first or present tense of salvation. The present tense of salvation. The past tense of salvation, I mean to say. I have been saved by justification. It's talking about that. I have been saved, justified. That process of being justified has got nothing to do with trying to keep law, observe this or that, keep the Sabbath, you name it. All those things contribute nothing to your justification. But the proposition that the circumcision party were putting forward, because we know it from Acts 15 and elsewhere, is that in order to be saved, you must keep the law and be circumcised. So when we say be circumcised, we need to understand what that means. To be circumcised doesn't simply mean to be circumcised and that's it. Circumcision is used as a kind of proxy or shorthand to mean to be observant. Do you see? If you say to be observant, it's a shorthand. It means keep the whole law. To be circumcised means, obviously, literally to be circumcised. It literally means that. But it doesn't only mean that. It means and to obey the entire law that goes with it. Because being circumcised, we know from the Romans, from letters to the Romans, Paul tells us, doesn't he, in Romans 4, about the uselessness of being circumcised if you don't keep the law. So when you, this is the point, if you accept some of the things that go with the law, such as Sabbath, circumcision, etc., and say, I'm now going to become observant to that, but bear in mind, if you say, I'm obligated to be, and so are you. If you say that, you're now making yourself under the law. And I hasten just to clarify this. There's nothing at all wrong with keeping Sabbath if you want to. Nothing wrong with it in the least. You're totally free to keep the Sabbath. You're totally free not to keep the Sabbath. Totally free. The people who just keep the Sabbath because they want to, it's absolutely fine. Let's imagine you say, I'm going to read my Bible every morning. That's absolutely fine. But what if you wanted to read it in the afternoon instead? That's absolutely fine. Well, what if you wanted to read it in the evening instead? That's absolutely fine. So what God is doing is treating us as a grown-up. He's telling us, do what you think is right. And as you grow in character and become more and more like me, you'll increasingly do what's right. That's okay? And so you can't just take a aspect of the law and say, I'm going to keep that. There are two problems with saying that, you see. Number one, if you say, I'm just going to keep that, and if you say, I'm obligated to keep that, then you become obligated to keep the whole law. Because you can't have part of it. And so the point is, if you say that, you've got to do it all. And let me use this analogy. Because the purpose of the law of Moses, let's say this first, the purpose, what was its purpose? Because it had a purpose, and its purpose was to show you that you're a sinner. So the nature of the law of Moses is essentially, it's a thermometer to show you that you're ill. So the thermometer of the law shows you that you've got a temperature of 103. But that thermometer does nothing to make you better. You can't be made better by a thermometer. What would you say to a doctor or nurse who gave you a thermometer and you said, well, okay, I've got a fever. Well, what's the treatment? Well, you keep that thermometer. Keep it in your mouth. All times. That's what observance of the law would be the same as. It can tell you that you've got a fever or that you've got hypothermia, but it cannot make you better. That's not its purpose, and it never was. No person has ever gained righteousness through keeping the law. We've been told by James, and we're told many other times, nobody ever kept the law except Jesus Christ. And it's important to bear that in mind, because why would you want to volunteer to keep a thing that nobody's ever kept? Don't you think that if it could be done, Paul would have done it? Don't you think if it could have been done, Isaiah would have managed it? Don't you think Daniel would have done it? Or are you better than Daniel, better than Paul, better than Isaiah? Do you see what I mean? How can you possibly attempt to keep a thing that nobody's ever kept? And you might say, well, yeah, but I'm not trying to keep all of it, I'm just trying to keep some of it. But don't you know, don't you see, that if you don't keep it all, then you're a lawbreaker. And you're no better off. So let me say this. In theory, a person could be saved, couldn't they? By not having a sin nature in the first place, which is difficult to arrange. And also by totally and perfectly keeping the law of Moses throughout your entire life without any off day or off moment, ever. Now, if you did that, in theory, you'd have perfect righteousness, wouldn't you? There's only one snag. Nobody's ever done it, except for Jesus, I hasten to add. And so, to try to keep the law of Moses is effectively, what are you really saying when you say that you are obligated to keep it, or that you're going to keep it? Well, you're effectively saying, I'm going to contribute something to the justification process. I'm going to contribute something to my salvation, brackets, justification, by keeping the Sabbath, or keeping this, or keeping that, by being circumcised, by whatever. You know, only the other day, I was followed by a man on Twitter, and I looked at his profile, and it said that he's a Gentile, observant Gentile, keeping the law of Moses. And I wrote to him, sending him a copy from YouTube of my talks on Galatians. He's not replied to me yet. But there he is. These people are not imaginary. They're there, and they're many of them who think it, to varying levels. But the essential point is they think, I'm going to add a little bit. I'm going to add a little bit of righteousness to me by doing this or doing that. And any person that wants to keep the law tends to have a tendency, they tend to have a trait of wanting to make you do it as well. They're like a person that's gone on some special diet where they eat 4 tangerines or something in the morning and they want you to do that. They think, do you see, well, they can eat tangerines in the morning if they want to. That's great. But they mustn't try and make you do it, do you see? But they do have a tendency to want to make you do it. And that they mustn't do. So, to use another analogy about the law and the uselessness of trying to keep some of it, consider this. It's a little like this. Keeping the law of Moses is like swimming the Atlantic. Nobody has ever done it. It cannot be done. And the point is this. Depending on who you are, you'll get a certain distance across the Atlantic and then you'll drown. Now, Paul was probably the greatest man who ever lived apart from Jesus. But he would have drowned somewhere in the middle of the Atlantic. He kept the law better than anybody. And he explains it, doesn't he? In 2 Corinthians, I think. He explains, he wasn't boasting, but he was just telling you. He was telling you for your sake. Don't think you can do it, because I can't do it, so you certainly can't do it. Now, he wasn't boasting, he was just telling you a fact. If I can't do it, you can't do it. And what Paul meant, well, what I'm saying about Paul, whether he's saying it or not, is that he was probably one of the greatest men who ever lived, and he could not keep the law of Moses. So neither can you. So, back to our Atlantic analogy. We all say, right, I'm going to swim the Atlantic. Even though Paul drowned in the mid-Atlantic, I'm going to swim it. And you get 2 miles out and you drown. But another man is more righteous than you. He gets 4 miles out and he drowns. And then another chap, he's incredibly righteous, and he gets 22 miles out and he drowns. But what would it really benefit you if you could actually swim and the Statue of Liberty was just in sight and you drown? Do you see? At some point across the Atlantic, you will fail to swim the Atlantic. At some point in keeping the law of Moses, you'll fail to keep the law of Moses. If you do, you're the same as the man that drowned 100 yards out when he started the swim. You're exactly the same. You're a lawbreaker, and you have gained nothing by keeping all these things. Other than, probably, quite a bit of pride and self-righteousness, which is the exact opposite of what Jesus wants us to have. So you can't add anything to the righteousness that's imputed to you. That's all the righteousness that you can ever have, or could ever have, or would ever want to have. If you've got the righteousness of Jesus Christ imputed to you, there is nothing you can do to add a little more to it. You can't just put a bit of chocolate sauce on top to make it just that bit better. Do you see? That is entire perfect righteousness. Your keeping of the Sabbath, whether you keep it well or badly, contributes nothing at all to your righteousness. Now, if you like to keep the Sabbath because you like to, it's absolutely fine. I read the Bible in the morning mainly, but if you like to read it in the evening, that's absolutely fine. And I shouldn't try and make you do it in the morning, and you shouldn't try and make me do it in the evening. Do you see? You just do what you want to do. And God wants each of us to do what we think right based on our understanding of Scripture, our conscience, our growing Christian character, our growing understanding and appreciation of the principles of his nature and what he would do. Do you see? You know when you really get to know a person and you know what they would do? Well, that's what he wants us to do, to get to really know him and to know what he would do. And so the difference between the law of Moses being so prescriptive, do this, do exactly this, do it exactly in this way, don't mix these cloths, don't eat this kind of bird, do eat this kind of fish, but don't eat this kind of thing. All these things are prescriptive. It's a little bit like this analogy I use to compare it with the way that we are now under the law of Christ. The law of Christ gives you the freedom to listen to conscience, to read the Bible, to apply biblical principles, to do what feels right and seems right to you, listening to the Holy Spirit's voice, listening to conscience in the circumstances you face, and perhaps coming to different conclusions from someone else. That's all right. So it's a little bit like this. What God says in the law of Moses is a little bit like telling a brand new trainee nurse exactly what to do to give pain relief to a patient. So you say to a brand new nurse who's been in the job 2 weeks, and you're a sort of a sister or whatever you are that's in charge, you've got this brand new nurse and you say, right, this chap, I want you to give him pain relief. I want you to do this. I want you to give him this. I want you to give him at this time. I want you to give him this amount, and I want you to stay with him when he has it. I want to check what he does. I want you to then do this. I want you to do that. And then I want you to come and see me, and then I want to... And you tell them exactly what to do, because they're a two-week nurse. But what would that... What would be said to a 10-year qualified nurse? You would say, give appropriate pain relief. And that 10-year qualified nurse would do all the same things that this two-week nurse has been told to do. But they would look at the patient, think about it, consider how much pain he's in, consider how much you dare give him, consider how long he's got to live, consider what's happening next, consider how conscious you want to keep him. You think, well, I'm going to keep him in a bit of pain because I want to keep him awake. Or all sorts of issues you might keep in mind. And you take all those principles, all those issues, all those considerations into account and use your judgment and make a decision. Now that is quite like the law of Christ. He wants you to know him, to know what he's like, to know what he wants, to know how he thinks, to know what he prioritizes, to know what he doesn't like. And in applying all those principles, with increasing effectiveness and accuracy, as you get older and more mature, you decide what to do in the situation that you face today. Now that's what we mean by the law of Christ. It's keeping Jesus' commands. But why do we keep Jesus' commands now? Because Jesus tells us that if we keep his commands, he'll know that we love him if we keep his commandments. So, am I standing here saying don't obey Jesus Christ, don't obey the Bible? Not in the least. We're to obey the Bible, we're to obey Jesus, we're to obey the voice of the Holy Spirit, we're to obey our conscience. But we're to do it like the nurse that's 10-year qualified and has been told give appropriate pain relief. Do you see? We're to do it like that. And we're to do it not to gain righteousness. We're to do it because it's right. So the reason that we do what we do is not because we want to gain righteousness. We do it because it's good. We do it because we want to. We do it because we love him and want to do what's right. We actually want what's right. Now previously, the law of Moses essentially presupposed that you were not wanting what was right. It was telling you what to do. The law of Christ treats you as a grown-up rather than as a child and asks you as a grown-up, for example, let's use another analogy. God wants you to go to bed at the right time. Now, how does God get you to go to bed at the right time? He says, I don't think there is a verse in the Bible that quite says this, but God says, go to bed at the right time. Now, if you were 6 years old, you tell a six-year-old when to go to bed, don't you? But if you're 60 years old, or 50 years old, or 20 years old, God doesn't want to tell a 50-year-old when to go to bed. And that's the difference between the law of Moses and the law of Christ. The law of Christ treats us as a grown-up who has become a son. And so we've been adopted as sons. We've been taken into the family business. We're like a young man of 20 that's been taken into the family business by this father who puts on him the robe of manhood that makes him a man and says, I treat you now as a man, not as a boy. And I'm going to take away the pedagogue that you used to have. You remember that? The pedagogue that takes you to the teacher, that brings you along, makes you do things like a childminder. You're no longer going to have a childminder because the law is likened to a childminder by Paul. So the law is a childminder that gets you to go to bed on time, that gets you to brush your teeth, that gets you to tidy your bedroom, that gets you to do this. But when you reach 20, your father puts a robe of adulthood on you, you see, and says, you're an adult now. I'm taking you into the family business. Your decisions, I'll stand by them. Now, can you think, if your dad was the managing director of a business and he took you in and he said, you're in the family business now, I'll stand by your decisions. Now, if he said to you, I'll stand by your decisions, can you see how that doesn't cause you to want to have license to go and have a jamboree and waste the company's money and be stupid? On the contrary, having just been told that, it brings upon you a kind of sobering sense of responsibility. Because the managing director has just told you, he's your dad, he's just told you, he's taken the childminder away, he's told you that he's going to stand by your decisions and honour them. You enter into a contract on behalf of the company, he's going to honour it, even if it was a bad decision. That gives you a sense of responsibility that actually, in a sense, sobers you and restrains you. And that's how he wants you to be. Not like a six-year-old who's got to go to bed because he's being told to. So, let me just perhaps finish by looking at one or two problem passages. Because if you do talk about Galatians, you will come across people who will point out to you Matthew 5. Now, you'll all be familiar with Matthew 5 from the Sermon on the Mount. And here, if you read this quickly, it sounds as though Jesus is disagreeing with Paul. Because look what he's saying in Matthew 5. And this is a verse which you will have frequently quoted to you if you say we're not under the law. I can tell you that with total confidence because it keeps being quoted to me. So I've looked at this verse and had to deal with it in one of my talks. But what is Jesus talking about in Matthew 5? Now he says, this is how it says in the King James, think not that I am come to destroy the law or the prophets. I am not come to destroy, but to fulfill. For verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass, one iota or one tittle shall in no wise pass from the law till all be fulfilled. Okay, that's Matthew 5, 17 and 18. Okay, now let's just dwell on this for a minute. Because do you agree with me? On first sight, it looks as though Jesus is saying the opposite of what Paul is saying, the opposite of what James is saying, the opposite of what Peter was saying. Sounds like it, doesn't it? But what you have to do is look closely at what Jesus is saying, very closely, because what does he say he's not come to do? He has not come to destroy the law. Well, he hasn't. He's come to fulfill the law. Now, what Jesus is saying here is entirely consistent with what Paul is saying, and it's entirely consistent with what James is saying. It would be, because it has the same editor-in-chief, doesn't it? That's doing all of this. So what does Jesus mean? He's not come to destroy. What does destroy mean? To destroy has in it the implication that the law is bad and wrong and needs to be condemned, destroyed in the sense of vandalized, smashed to pieces. It's not good. And Jesus is saying, I'm not come to do that. Well, what does he say he has come to do? To fulfill the law. What does fulfill the law mean? Well, he means by it that he has come to completely and perfectly obey it in the way that you could never do. So one of the things that he was doing was to totally and perfectly fulfill this thing that James tells us that none of us could ever do and have ever done. Well, Jesus did it. And the point is that not only did Jesus have total righteousness to begin with, but he also has the righteousness that comes from a total and perfect and lifelong, flawless observance of the entire law of Moses. And that righteousness also can be given to us through him, imputed to us. All his righteousness, the righteousness he already has, and the righteousness that comes from fulfilling the law in its entirety. Now, he came to do that. And having done that, the law is at an end. And if you listen to my talks on YouTube, you'll see I go through this in exhaustive detail, all the different times where the law is said to be at an end, completed, we're not under it, and so forth, in loads of different angles. We're not under it because the law ended when Jesus died. And Paul deals with that at length in Romans as well. We're not under it because Jesus died. When he died, the law ended. Now, the Mosaic covenant was the only covenant that isn't permanent. All the others are permanent. The Abrahamic covenant is permanent. The Davidic covenant, the new covenant, all these covenants are permanent, but not the Mosaic. The Mosaic is temporary. And it was until Jesus died, then it ended. We're not now under it. And so, Jesus addresses that in Luke chapter 16, 16 and 17. Look at that. I'm not going to deal with it just now, but he speaks about how the law and prophets were until John. Remember? Now, check that out later maybe. But what I'm getting at here is, you mustn't think that because he has not come to destroy the law, that that means he has not come to fulfill or end the law. You can fulfill and end something without destroying it. And an analogy that I think God gave me on this was this. Imagine you have a mortgage, okay? Now, imagine that you were to go to your bank or building society and pay the mortgage. And imagine that a relative left you an inheritance and then a day came when you were able to pay off the mortgage. And you go down to the bank with a big check and you hand it over to the bank. And you say, here is X thousand pounds in payment of my mortgage. So what Jesus was doing in a certain sense, in keeping the law of Moses, he was handing over a check, meeting its conditions and terms and requirements in every way. So when you say to the lady at the bank, here is a check, would you say, I have come to destroy my mortgage? You wouldn't. You'd say, I have come to fulfill my mortgage. Do you see? So you could say, if you wanted to look a little weird in the bank, you could say, think not that I have come to destroy my mortgage. I have not come to destroy my mortgage, but to fulfill it. Do you see? Now, the police will be being called at this time while you're saying this. They'll probably keep you waiting while they arrive. But you could say that to the bank. Now, do you see the shade of meaning? Do you see there's a difference between destroying and fulfilling? So what Jesus is saying is, I haven't come to in any way say that the law is bad. And there's nothing wrong with the law. The law is a perfect thermometer. It's in complete, perfect working order. And when the law says that you've got a temperature of 103.6, guess what your temperature is? It's 103.6 because the law is in perfect working order. I am not come to say that this thermometer is not working properly. This thermometer is working properly. Sorry? Yeah? Sorry, I can't quite hear. Do you want to shout it?
Sorry. One thing that can cause confusion.
Yeah?
On verse 18, I agree with what you're saying.
I'm yeah? Yeah.
Well, I believe that's a bit of a question to that. What it actually means is that if you're going to try and keep the law, it's going to judge you at the end of time. So the law will exist, judge you.
Well, shall I just address that? Because you're not picking up on the microphone, you see, so it'll just be a blank on the tape on here. But the point is, let me address that point. Verse 18 in Matthew 5, he says, for verily I say unto you, till heaven and earth pass away, it says in the RSV, pass away, not one iota or one tittle shall pass from the law till all be fulfilled. In the RSV it says, till all is accomplished. In here, in the King James it says, till all be fulfilled. So what is he saying? Now remember I said there are different meanings of the word law. Okay? And there's also the prophets. So what is Jesus saying? None of it will pass away till it's accomplished. Well, we all agree with that. Not one bit of the law or the prophets or any part of it will pass away until it's accomplished. So let's take that in its various component parts. The law of Moses will not pass away until it's accomplished or fulfilled, as King James says. Well, it has been fulfilled. How do we know that? Because Jesus says he has come to fulfill it. So that's our clue. He says, I have come to fulfill it. So why then are we doubting whether it's been fulfilled? So the law, the 613 commands, were fulfilled by Jesus' life, in perfect compliance with it, and his death. Those things brought the law of Moses to an end, the 613 commands. Right, what about the rest then? Does Jesus' life and death bring to an end the book of Isaiah? No. Does it bring to an end the book of Zechariah? No. Or what about Revelation? Does it bring that to an end? No. Those books remain in place, as does every part of the Bible. It all remains in place, except for the 613 commands, which we're no longer under. But everything else, the prophecies and everything that's going to happen, the things that the Bible says are going to happen, are going to happen. Now, when they have happened, at the end of time, when we enter into the new Jerusalem, the new heaven, the new earth, when that comes, they will have been fulfilled. The book of Zechariah will be over in the same way that the law of Moses is over now. So when we're in the eternal state in the new Jerusalem, I don't mean this irreverently, but we won't need the Bible as it was, because it will have been fulfilled and serve its purpose. It'll be over. Now, what Jesus is saying is, nothing at all will pass away until it is accomplished. He didn't say it will never pass away. He said it will never pass away until it's accomplished. So what you have to ask yourself in respect of any given thing is, has it been accomplished? All right then, let's take the law of Moses, the 613 commands. Have they been accomplished? Yes, they have. And the reason I say so is, I've got 50 reasons for saying so, because the Bible says it all over the place. Yes, sorry.
Yeah. What about the Levitical feasts? The antithesis of the last three, the autumn feasts, have not been fulfilled yet.
Yeah.
First four, I believe, have been, but the last three haven't.
Okay.
So
righto. Okay. Well, the keeping of the feasts, you mean, have they been fulfilled in that sense?
Yeah.
Well, their prophetic significance and meaning hasn't been fulfilled. They remain to be fulfilled in the sense that they have a typological significance and value. What I mean is, various things in the Bible are types of what's coming. They're types and they have significance and meaning. Those will all be fulfilled in due course. But the obligation to do things pursuant to the law of Moses is over. But let's take, for example, the prophet Daniel. Is he fulfilled? No, he's not. And even Daniel was told, shut up the book until the end, because these are not, this is going to all make sense in the end. Sorry?
I agree with everything you said.
Yeah.
The question is, what about Messianic Jews?
Yeah.
Should they cease to have their body circumcised?
That's a good question. Yeah, the question was, it won't have been picked up on the tape, should Messianic Jews get little boys circumcised? And the answer is they should. And that's a very good question. But why should they? And the thing is this. There's a good illustration, if you take the New Testament, which God deliberately put there. And it's the different way in which Paul treated Titus and Timothy. Have you ever noticed this? And if you come across certain commentators, they think Paul's confused. Or he's a bit hypocritical. Or he's a little bit changeable in his moods. So one day he felt like circumcising Timothy. Poor old Timothy. But the other day, another day, he didn't feel in the mood, so Titus got away with it. Now, is that what happened? No, it's not. Now, why did Paul circumcise Timothy but not Titus? And the answer is this. He circumcised Timothy because Timothy was Jewish. He was half Jewish, but he had a Greek dad and a Jewish mother. But well, when he was a baby, they didn't bother circumcising him. When Paul learned of this, he said to Timothy, you need circumcising. So Paul did that. So then Timothy spent a week walking like John Wayne, and then he was circumcised. That was done for him. But not Titus. Why not Titus? Because Titus was a full Greek. He wasn't Jewish at all. All right, so what are we saying then? Are we saying that Timothy had to obey the law of Moses? No, we're not. The reason Timothy was circumcised is nothing at all to do with the law of Moses. He was circumcised in order to meet the conditions of the Abrahamic covenant. Now, it just so happens that the same physical act is used as a symbol of both those covenants. So, under the Mosaic covenant, boys are circumcised 8 days. Under the Abrahamic covenant, circumcised. For a different reason, different purpose, and a different audience. Now, the Abrahamic covenant and the circumcision that's required under it is applicable only to Jews. The Mosaic covenant is applicable only to Jews and those who want to become Jews, but it's over. So, this is where confusion enters in. The requirement to be circumcised under the law of Moses is over, and nobody has to be circumcised under the law of Moses. Now, that's why it is not necessary for Gentiles to get circumcised under the law of Moses. But poor old Timothy had to be, because he was a Jew and he had to be circumcised to keep the Abrahamic covenant. Because the Abrahamic covenant, the visible, practical demonstration that you are claiming the benefit of the Abrahamic covenant as a physical descendant of Isaac and Jacob, is that you get circumcised. If you don't, then you're cutting yourself off from the Abrahamic covenant as a Jewish person. That's the point. If you want to be part of the Abrahamic covenant as a Jewish person and be a physical descendant of Isaac and Jacob, then you must get circumcised because you are a physical Jew, genetically a Jew. But if you're not a Jew, you do not have to get circumcised, because the Abrahamic covenant, we still benefit from it, but we benefit from the wider ramifications of the Abrahamic covenant. The benefits and blessings that it brings come to us, but thankfully without circumcision. But if you're a Jew, you must get circumcised under the Abrahamic covenant. Is that clear? Sounds a little contradictory, doesn't it? But it's not contradictory. And Paul wasn't being confused. So,
who wasn't?
Yes, if a Jewish person, let's imagine, you want to get really technical now, imagine a Jewish man who had not somehow been circumcised, which is a bit difficult because they nearly all are, but imagine somehow he hadn't been. But bear in mind, even the most secular atheistic Jew, you check, every single one of their kids gets circumcised. But let's go with your thing. Let's imagine somehow a Jewish person didn't get circumcised and he then somehow became a believer in Jesus. What is he? What's his technical status? He would be a beneficiary under the Abrahamic covenant as a kind of quasi-Gentile, wouldn't he? So he wouldn't be a beneficiary in terms of the land ownership. He wouldn't benefit from the land promises that are contained within the Abrahamic covenant. But he would benefit from the promises that are aimed at us as Gentiles. So that would be his position. He'd cut himself off from those parts of that covenant.
I agree with some.
Yeah, okay.
I have confusion problems myself.
Yeah.
With this kind of thing. Because the Torah is teaching, and you rightly say, you know, we're taught. And
my question is, you know, if we're taught by Torah, you know, from a child to an adult.
Yeah.
Why then are we so quick in our history as Christians to do away with the Sabbath? Because you know, majority of Christians they see the Sabbath as a Sunday now. So
that's right.
What I'm saying is you know, I, as a believer, I'm blessed by the Sabbath.
Yeah,
you know?
That's great.
And I'm not putting that on anybody else, but I've been taught that from Scripture.
Yeah. Well, no. The point is, I'm not standing here saying that you shouldn't keep the Sabbath.
No.
But you see, Even if a person says to keep the Sabbath, if you probe a little more deeply, you'll generally find they break the Sabbath because they don't keep it at the right time. Because they've got to wait till there's just the three stars in the sky, then the Sabbath begins, and then it ends when that ceases to be the case the following day. So the Sabbath is from Friday evening at some point, not at any point, that point, and it ends on Saturday evening at that point. And you've got to keep it in that way, because that's what the Sabbath means. But what most Christians mean when they want to be Sabbatarians, they mean Sunday. So it's the Chariots of Fire scenario with, what's his name, Harold Abrahams, or what his name was. There's the other one, and then there's, what's his name, the runner? Eric Liddell. Yeah, Eric Liddell is keeping the Sabbath, and, you know, he's a God-fearing man, and I think God was pleased with him, although probably having a little chuckle at him as well. Because there he was, giving up that Olympic gold medal to not run on a Sunday. If he had said to God, would it be all right if I run on a Sunday? God would have said, yeah, it's fine, if you want to run on a Sunday. But the point is that Eric Liddell, his conscience didn't want to let him run on a Sunday. Now, he had to obey his conscience, because his own conscience told him that he mustn't run on a Sunday. So the point is, if your conscience tells you that, then you need to go with your conscience. But the thing that you'd be obeying would be your conscience, not the law of Moses. Yeah.
I believe that Sabbath really was put down, set down, really, in Genesis.
Yeah. The Sabbath is a great idea. That's right. The Sabbath is a good thing. Yeah. The Sabbath is a good thing. So no one's against it. And do you remember, let's take Paul as our witness. Romans 4:21, I think it is. I'm doing it from memory. I think Romans 4:21, I think Paul says, do we then overthrow the law by this faith? By no means. On the contrary, we uphold the law. That's what Paul says. So what he means is the thing I've just said about going to the building society and destroying your mortgage. He's saying, do we abolish the law? Do we overthrow? He uses the word overthrow in RSV. We don't overthrow the law. We're not saying it's bad. So keeping Sabbath is a good thing. The Sabbath is a good idea. It's a good way to rest, and it's a good way to focus on family and God and rest. It's a very good thing. The problem is in saying you must do it. Why must you do it? Implicitly, the implication is in order to be saved, in order to have righteousness, in order to have that little bit of extra righteousness more than other Christians who don't keep the Sabbath. Yes, sorry?
I'm sorry, just one more thing. It's just that Yeshua, Jesus, said that Sabbath was made for man.
Yeah.
But God knows that man needs rest.
Of course it does, yeah. That's right, but the man needs rest, that's for sure, and it's a good idea. But God is now treating us as grown-ups, and he's saying, get rest when you think it's right. So you can have Sabbath on a Tuesday if you want it. You can worship on a Wednesday. You can do a Bible study on a Friday. You can do what you like. God is just happy with you doing what you want to do. But what?
I agree with that. I mean, personally, I believe that Jesus is our Sabbath. You know, he's
okay.
Sabbath.
Yeah.
Of
course, yeah. Well, we're in violent agreement. I wouldn't know how to agree more strongly with you. The thing is, we totally agree that the Sabbath is a nice and good thing, and a helpful thing, a beneficial thing. There's nothing wrong with it. It's a good thing. The problem is twofold. Thinking you can gain some righteousness from keeping it. And secondly, trying to make other people do it. So, you know, if you want to keep Sabbath, it's absolutely fine. No problem whatsoever. Sorry.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm a messianic, but yeah. I was born Gentile.
Yeah.
I was already born again when I came to the level of understanding about the Sabbath and the feast.
Yeah.
And I found them to be a huge blessing.
Yeah.
Now, like you're saying, though, I don't put it on everybody else. I'll just state that this is my position.
Yeah.
Okay. And I've found a fellowship that meets, the Saturday. I'm playing hooky today, sorry. But, you know, they do the feast as well.
Yeah.
And rather than, I don't make people do it, but what I do share is what a blessing it is to be able to do it.
Well, I'm in violent agreement with you as well. I'm very violent today. So
yeah,
I totally agree.
Honestly feel...
Yeah.
The Most High has been leading me in that direction in the last few years.
That's terrific.
And, you know, I try and do kosher as well. I don't accept it as a law that if I don't quite do it, well, you know, that's a big sin.
Well, there are some advantages to kosher food because it's more healthy.
Exactly, yeah. That was what I was going to say, that, I have learned there are health benefits
to it.
Like, there's all sorts of parasites in pig meat.
In pig meat,
that
are
not got rid of by cooking, for
example.
Right.
Yeah.
You can contract.
But can we all see the difference between a good idea and an obligation?
Yeah.
It's a good idea to go for a jog in the morning. There's a law that I break because I don't. Although it's a very good idea, I don't do it. But you see, it would be a good idea if I did, but it's not an obligation. And so all these things, we're free to do them, free not to do them. So anyway, that was a whistle-stop tour through Galatians and the rest of the universe.
Thank you very
much. All while we wait for Jay Smith to come.
Thanks ever so much, Sean. Thank you, everybody. Thank you, Sean.